Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. College graduation season is winding down, and in some cases, there's more finality to this year's ceremonies. Take Wheelock College, for example, whose final graduation was just last week.
Today is a particularly notable event in the history of Wheelock College, as members of the Wheelock community come together to celebrate Wheelock College's final commencement.
The school will be merging with Boston University next fall, and most of Wheelock's faculty and staff will lose their jobs. There was also the recent controversial buyout of Mount Ida College by the University of Massachusetts. Our next guest says these two recent local examples of the difficulties facing smaller colleges should serve as a warning to higher education. John Marcus is a higher education editor at the Hechinger Report. Hi there, John.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Gloria Larson. She's retiring president of Bentley University. Under Larson's tenure, Bentley transitioned from a college to a university. She also helped open the university's Center for Women and Business. And you're going to be talking about this possible warning to higher education, but we should say you're not a small college. So welcome.
I'm delighted to join you.
Okay, thanks very much. So, John, let's start with you. Back in 2013, you started writing really heavily about this, and you looked at, I think, the records of 1,700 colleges and universities and estimated that about a third of them were on what you called then an unsustainable financial path. What do you think has happened since you wrote about that in 2013? Have you been proven right?
Things have only gotten worse. New statistics out just yesterday show that there were 275,000 fewer students this semester, this spring semester just ending, than there were last spring. That means that there are 3 million fewer college students than there were at the last peak in 2011. That's an unprecedented decline in enrollment. And the 6 out of the 10 states where the enrollment decline is the sharpest are in the Northeast and the Midwest. Mm. And that particularly threatens smaller, very tuition-dependent regional institutions like Mount Ida. There are going to be a lot more of those.
So, but is that sort of because of demographics? That's what's happening to the population right now, right? It's not really a function of the atmosphere for higher education as a business in general, right?
There are fewer 18-year-olds and traditional age college students. There are also older than traditional age adults who were fueling significant increases in enrollment up to and including the Great Recession have now been sort of sucked back into the workforce. Mm-hmm. So you see that combination of events significantly affecting enrollment at these colleges.
Mm-hmm. So typically when a business looks at that and says, okay, here my market's shrinking, I've got to cut costs, I've got to reduce salaries or employees or lay people off. That happening in higher education, or what's going on to try to deal with this?
Not everywhere. If you look at Mount Ida, for example, as we have very closely, the last 25 years, Mount Ida increased its number of administrators by 156% during a period when the enrollment was declining by 12%. So if you look at productivity as a measuring it by number of staff, universities and colleges have, unlike almost every other sector, every other industry in America, become less productive, not more productive. You are beginning to see some response to this kind of threat. So Wheelock, for example, in your introduction, has merged with Boston University. Mm-hmm. You'll see more mergers. You'll see more collaborative agreements for purchasing and security and those kinds of cross-registration, those kinds of things. But for the most part, universities are not significantly reducing their costs. In fact, they're borrowing more. When we think about higher education debt, we think about student loans. Universities and colleges collectively owe $250 billion in debt, which is now 9% of their operating costs going to servicing that debt. So all of those things collectively are bad news for colleges. It's just a perfect storm.
Gloria Larson, when you hear numbers like that, do you think it's quite as dire as we're thinking here? And what's to be done?
Well, I think more about how frustrating this is for families and for potential students to have fewer and fewer opportunities with different types of schools and just this narrowing of the base while they watch this incredible cost escalation that just seems to be endless. I mean, the cost of place-based education, which for most Americans is something like healthcare, the Cadillac version of what everyone wants for their kids, is incredibly expensive. You have personnel costs with tenured faculty who stay for very long, many, many decades, don't retire early in most cases. You have plant-based costs. The energy costs keep going up. The healthcare costs keep going up. So you have this never-ending cycle of a cost escalation factor. And then you have the changing demographics, at least in some parts of the country. Mm-hmm. Other parts of the country have population booms. But I think what frustrates me the most isn't the model itself. It's the failure of higher ed to recognize that the model is problematic and to not look to the solutions in a more aggressive way. I find higher ed generally, after 11 years in higher ed, and I do think that Bentley is different than this, to be very much in a bubble. Mm. They're not looking externally for the answers. They're not inviting industry in. They're not inviting the very types of solutions to the table that might change right. things, including changing their curriculum to be more marketplace-based.
Well, that sort of goes along to what you've said, John, right? That they've become less productive, so they're not really taking aggressive steps to sort of deal with this,
they're
right?
They're less productive both in terms of what they're teaching and how they're teaching, as well as how they run themselves. Mm. So it's a twofold issue. Yeah,
but then you get into the whole debate here, right, of liberal arts versus career. And it's, you know, how do you get the right balance and get the depth of an education if you try to do everything, right? I mean, that's the crux of the question.
I think it's an and, not an or. And Bentley is a model of that. We decided before the recession that we were going to, we call it fusion, fully integrate business and the liberal arts, that companies wanted both hard and soft skills. They wanted lifelong learners, but they wanted kids who could also have, through internships in the classroom, have actual skill sets to bring to the workplace, professional skill sets, technology capabilities. And so we were studied by a group from Stanford and the Carnegie Foundation back in 2000 and 2008, right when I got to Bentley, to see what we were doing to bring liberal learning into the a business school. Mm. I think today liberal arts schools need to bring the business community, the nonprofit community, and others into their classroom too. So they can do the same thing. It's just in reverse. Mm. And they're not doing it.
Right. Wait, do you think that this is sort of a different kind of thinking about higher education, John Marcus? Because, you know, it used to be, okay, it's okay if you have a philosophy degree. At least you have a degree. Now it's like, I think I want my kid to get a job with a degree. And so maybe there should be a little accounting with philosophy, if that's such a thing.
As the price has gone up, people are very focused on return on investment. And right. there hasn't been a great job by many institutions, Bentley being an exception, of making the case for why you need those soft skills, why you need the liberal arts. I was at a conference recently in Washington of liberal arts colleges, and I went to a panel about selling the liberal arts, promoting the liberal arts, which are in significant decline. And if you look at their enrollment, it's declining in the double digits. Mm. And the first question they put up on the board was, define liberal arts. And to me, 20 years after an existential crisis in the liberal arts, you would imagine that by now, the people that offer liberal arts education would know what it means.
Know how to define it.
And so neither do students, neither do parents. But to be contrary to what journalists are supposed to do and look at the bright side, there are some institutions, including here in this community, that have been very preemptive, that have been very forward-looking, and taken really innovative steps to anticipate these problems. And one is Bentley. And one is Simmons, which has significantly expanded its graduate offerings, including online graduate offerings, and now has went from being very close to closing itself to being significantly in the black. Regis College, which was all women and became co-ed and also added a lot of graduate programs. It's not a coincidence to me that both Bentley and Simmons are run by non-academics, people who came from the business world or from law, and not necessarily from within academia, where the bubble is still pervasive and kind of blinds people to the bigger problems.
Let me add another example to the two that John mentioned, and that's Olin School of Engineering. It's a spectacular success. Everyone in the world wants Olin graduates, not just because of their engineering skill sets and knowledge, but because they have a partnership with Wellesley and Babson. And Babson offers business classes, and mm-hmm. Wellesley, of course, pure liberal arts. It's a perfect marriage of three schools that understand that you need to integrate all of these things if you're going to be successful in a hybrid marketplace where jobs are changing in the nature of what is required on literally, every couple of years basis.
Right, but are you talking about niche markets here, right? I mean, instead of many young kids going to school may not know what they're going to school, what they want to go to school for, and isn't college supposed to be a time to... I've got to play devil's advocate here.
No, it is. I actually totally agree with you about that. That's why you do need the liberal arts. That's why you need... You don't have to pick Olin specifically. You don't have to pick... At Bentley, you can major in the liberal arts at Bentley, but you're going to get a degree, a broad-based business degree at the same time. And we're constantly explaining this to students who aren't coming for economics and finance. We're saying, you know what? You want to study, you're about climate change. You have a passion for that. You want to change things. We have two different sustainability science majors. We have amazing labs on our campus, biosciences. If you major in sustainability science and double major in economics and finance, there's not a wind farm startup or a new tech, green tech company in the country that's not going to pluck you from the 4,000 applications and give you the job. Why? Because you have a passion for it, you know the science, you found something that you want to devote your life to, and at the same time, you can read a balance sheet. And you're going to do internships in the field before you get the job.
So internships. Are we seeing more and more of this? Is this also...
Yes, we are seeing more of those additional kind of add-ons to a conventional education that I think keeps students focused on the finish line. Your point is well taken about majors. For example, a lot of students who don't declare their majors early in their university careers or change majors end up never graduating. That's a massive problem. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily true of a lot of small private nonprofits, but collectively, American universities, the graduation rate is about 50% after 6 years. 50% of their students graduate after 6 years. If you were a private business in any other industry and you had that level of a success rate, you'd be out of business. Mm. And so there's also that question of effectiveness. But to pick up on your comment about Olin College, it is a very innovative educational model. It's also a really good model of how expensive that kind of an offering can be.
It has more been, expensive than what we think of as a traditional higher
education. It's got 300 students, and it's blown through hundreds of millions of dollars of its original endowment. Mm. It's a very expensive model. But it also is educating future engineers. We need engineers. And that speaks to the bigger problem for us regionally and nationally, which is that if we lose these institutions, we fall behind. Not only does it affect our economy locally in a place like Massachusetts, which is heavily dependent on higher education, 480 jobs at Mount Ida, 110 jobs lost at Wheelock. But it also, these students fuel other industries, whether they're pizza shops or real estate, off-campus apartments, and then more broadly and much more importantly to Boston is the innovation and the entrepreneurial spin-offs of these institutions that we so heavily depend on in this knowledge economy.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that business model, because obviously in the private sector, that's not sustainable, right? It's not sustainable at all. And we've heard a lot about adjunct professors, right, who make very little money. And roughly most schools are, I think on average, about 40% of their faculty are adjuncts who are paid just a couple thousand dollars per class and get no benefits. And many adjuncts, there was a very public battle with adjuncts at Bentley just a couple of years ago, and they were saying, you know, we're carrying the load here for
union
higher education.
It was a battle over it was a forming battle a over union. Union.
Yeah, and they did form it, and they did get an increase for their course wages. But I'm wondering, you know, and at the same time, there's also criticism about the number of administrators, the salaries for administrators. So how do you deal with that? Should that be a strict business model, or is that a factor, or is that just perception? John, you first.
I think that's beginning to change. I think that's beginning to change because of consumer demand. Universities really didn't have to be responsive to consumer demand when there was an unending supply of freshmen. That's no longer the case. There's a lot of public pressure. There's a lot of public scrutiny. There's unfortunately a lot of public skepticism. If you look at surveys about higher education and what the American public thinks of it, it was once held on sort of a moral high ground. I think that all of us felt that way about higher ed. I think it's unfortunate that pretty much all institutions are painted with the same broad brush, whether they're doing a good job or not. But that's something that I think they're finally responding to. Public universities and colleges are increasingly being held to account for their completion rates, graduation rates, and, mm-hmm. and other outcomes because their states are funding them based on their performance. So these things are beginning to shift.
And go ahead, Gloria.
Well, I was just going to add to what John's saying that I believe that one of the things that has hamstrung colleges is that they never had to be transparent. Now they have to be transparent, but they're not yet. They don't know how to be. You have to be able to talk about your results. It's not just the pure ROI of how many of your students percentage-wise get jobs or how long the completion rate is, although those are incredibly important things. But also, you know, what does a classroom look like? How many students are in a classroom? What mm-hmm. kinds of internships do you get for your students? Where's the career office and what kind of results do they have in terms of getting students into areas that they need to with opportunities for internships and other types of employment, chances to show what they're learning at school? So I think that it's this, and the government has called for increased transparency. And my problem with higher ed is that too many schools have sort of barricaded themselves in and are still letting the light in and limiting the amount of information that they're giving parents. I think what's changed in the United States and is going to keep changing is it's not so important where you go to school, is how you go to school, the research you've done. What kinds of questions do you ask up front? We're talking about school accountability. I think parents and students have a lot of accountability too, as does the business community. We can't all just complain about higher ed. We have to help find the answers. And part of that is having certainly parents and students do the homework up front.
And what about, though, the adjunct issue and the business model? I mean, does something need to be done about adjunct professors making up about 35% to 40% of the teaching staff?
You know, some of our adjuncts disproportionately, it's why we went through two rounds of unionization, a union battle, because the first year we won, and that's because so many of our adjuncts are business adjuncts. They're actual practitioners. And mm-hmm. we think bringing practitioners into the classroom is really important. So there are a lot of nuances to the adjunct situation, and every school is going to be different. It's not one size fits all. But back to the parents and the students, there's a lot that needs to be done up front. You mentioned the fact that students come in, as I did to college, without knowing mm-hmm. what I wanted to do, other than vaguely something about law school. What we do at Bentley is we give strengths finders to all of our students freshman year. They don't have to come in knowing what they're good at, what they want to do, right. what their passion is. We're going to help them early on. And this is a major change for colleges, too. I didn't even know if my alma mater had a career office when I was still in college. Mm. Didn't know how to find it, if it did exist. And if you found it, it was senior year, second semester, when you went, holy Toledo, I don't have a job and I'm supposed to get one. So that's changed dramatically, but many schools still have not caught up with the fact that you need to start day one freshman year. And the other thing we've not talked about is too many schools have fallen woefully behind in terms of having truly up-to-date wired and wireless campuses where the students themselves have facility in changing technologies. It's incredibly important. You can't go into the workplace without this. It's referred to as a T-shape. Yes, you still need depth of knowledge and subject matter, but you need broad knowledge as well. And you also need some technical capabilities along the way, and technology being first and foremost.
So John, I want to ask you, how do you think schools should prepare for primarily, if they were looking at this just as a straight demographic shift, losing customers? What should they be doing?
Well, I wish I knew the answer to that. I'd be in charge of higher education, but there are.
Well, who else is doing it right? You know, like, what are you seeing out there? So you mentioned Olin as being a good example. Who's doing it right?
So, let me answer the question in a little bit of a different way.
Okay.
So the new students, the demographic, the areas where we're seeing increases in 18 to 24 year olds tend to be first generation, racial and ethnic minority, and low income. Those are very expensive students to educate, often because they come from poorly resourced urban public schools where they're not well prepared, as smart as they are. They require more financial aid. They require more advising and support. So universities need to begin to adjust to that demand. I mean, you begin to become very sympathetic to universities. Even some of what Gloria was saying about the need to improve technology, all of this stuff is extraordinarily expensive. Mm. Everything we're asking universities to do to adjust to and anticipate these problems costs more money, not less. So who's doing it right? I'm not sure yet there's enough of a critical mass of universities and colleges that are doing it right to really draw attention to examples.
Hmm. Gloria Larson, what advice would you give smaller school administrators or presidents right now?
Well, I would be thinking about the relevance of what we're teaching, and that doesn't mean drop philosophy courses. You're going to need those. You're going to need the soft skills, the critical thinking. Please keep your liberal arts vibrant, but at the same time, take a look at how you take as a pure liberal arts play. Talk about how do you take something and make it relevant. It again makes me want to stand up and shout. There are answers. If you don't take your economics majors, if you don't take your math majors and look at the dire need for those who are facile with analytics, for example, with a math major, bring business in, partner with them around how you take your curriculum and make it relevant, match that with robust internship programs, make sure your career planning office is right there at the very beginning of the 4 years, and make sure you do the best you can to keep your technology up to date, because students today need hybrid capabilities, soft and hard skills. And frankly, looking at the future, artificial intelligence is going to overtake a lot of the things that were learned in sort of rote fashion in the past. So I actually believe that liberal arts are going to have a bigger play in the future than they do currently, because soft skills, human empathy, the ability to communicate well in all regards, those things are going to be particularly strong. So as I started out by saying, it's an and, not an or. You need the practical, professional opportunities that come with a good education, at the same time, the softer skills and lifelong learning that really will hold you over whatever comes in the marketplace now and 20 years later.
Right. John Marcus, you were very prescient in predicting what was going to be happening here in terms of smaller schools struggling and closing. And of course, now we're seeing it. So I'm going to ask you for another prediction here, because we're running out of time. What do you think we're going to see, say, 5 years from now?
More colleges closing and merging.
What's it going to look like? Like how many? Like
how many?
That's hard. Not exactly, obviously, but you know, give me an overall picture of a landscape.
I can't help but believe that universities and colleges who have watched Mount Ida and Wheelock and Antioch and Sweetbriar and the many other smaller colleges that have gone through this trauma are reacting now. I think they'll begin to look for solutions. Whether it's in time is another question.
All right. John Marcus is higher education editor at the Hechinger Report. Thanks very much
for
being with us. And also, Gloria Larson, president of Bentley University, steps down at the end of June. Starting in the fall, you'll be president in residence at the Harvard Graduate School of Education.
Looking forward to it. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, congratulations. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll talk with Evan Horowitz of the Boston Globe about rising gas prices and increasing interest rates. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.